I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, President Obama's new education budget could cut more than $70 million in aid to historically black colleges and universities. We'll ask why he's contemplating that cut, and we'll talk about how the HBCUs plan to cope. We'll have that conversation in just a few minutes. But first, we're going to continue our conversation about filling the upcoming vacancy on the Supreme Court. Justice David Souter's resignation earlier this month sparked intense debate over who President Obama should select as his successor. On most short list of potential nominees are several names that would represent historic firsts on the court, the first Latino justice, the first African-American woman. But this conversation has some observers worrying that too much attention is being paid to building diversity and too little to the judge's actual track record. Joining us to talk more about this are Harvard Law professors Charles Ogletree and Lonnie Guinier. Also with us is former United States Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Professor Ogletree, before we took our break, I was citing a piece in the Washington Post opinion pages entitled The Best Judges Obama Can't Pick by Benjamin Wittes, who talked about how this drive for ethnic or gender diversity and age, a younger justice, in part to counter the effect of Justices Alito, Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, may be causing the Obama administration to overlook some extremely talented and effective candidates. What's your take on this?
Well, it's laughable. I mean, it's an outrage that in the year 2009 we have one woman on the Supreme Court when women represent over 50% of the population. And it's laughable to think that white males are being excluded when they represent the majority of the court. They've always represented the majority of the court, and they were the only people on the court until Justice O'Connor became the first woman in 1981. And Thurgood Marshall, the first African American, in 1967. So it's not it's sort of a issue that's irrelevant. And the reality is that this president is in a position to find the best person possible. It's not a popularity contest. We don't have anybody from Iowa. We don't have anybody from the large state of California. It's not that kind of representative democracy. It is a Congress of one. It's Barack H. Obama. He'll pick the right person. And I'm very convinced, knowing him and knowing his judgment, that we're all going to ultimately be pleased that he's diversifying the court. And the idea of race, gender, sexual orientation, all those issues are important. And I'm certain that he won't ignore those in this choice or what I suspect will be other choices for the Supreme Court while he's president.
How does he decide what is most important, since so many of these issues are important to someone? How does he prioritize these questions?
It's pretty easy. If you think about how he put together his cabinet, when you think about the fact that he selected the first African-American in our history to be the Attorney General, the first woman in our history to be the Solicitor General, he prioritizes them by saying, what are we missing, what are we lacking, and how can I impact something that will be long after I'm gone. And that's how he prioritizes them, saying that there's talent in all shapes, sizes, and colors and genders, and I think that's going to be no surprise that he's going to find people who are extremely talented, extremely gifted, and who will be terrific justices for the next 30 or 40 years.
I wanted to ask our other guests, Judge Sonia Sotomayor seems to be a front runner, at least in terms of media mentions. But she's also received a good deal of negative press. In a recent article in The New Republic, Jeffrey Rosen interviewed several clerks who quote, anonymously, former colleagues. One of them said that she was, quote, not that smart, kind of a bully on the bench. And, of course, there's been a lot of response to this by people saying that these unnamed sources are inappropriate and that you can always find people to criticize people anonymously. I wanted to ask, Mr. Gonzalez, you were the focus of this kind of media discussion about the possibility of your being named to the court. Ultimately, you were not. But I wanted to ask, what role does this kind of mentioning play in the process? And I also wanted to ask if you feel that minority candidates are subject to special attention.
I think that, again, as I indicated earlier, this is a very important decision. And so people are going to have very strong views about the qualifications of potential nominees. And if you're a front runner, it just comes with the territory. There's going to be extra scrutiny on you. In a sense, quite frankly, these kinds of stories are helpful to the White House because you don't want to have the president nominate someone and be surprised by something in a person's background. And so oftentimes the White House will themselves leak a name or two in terms of people under consideration and see what kind of stories are generated. And so that kind of scrutiny, I think, is helpful to the process. I think it's not wise for a president to try to make a surprise pick. I think it's a good thing to have someone, the president nominate someone who people have thought about, people have considered, and this is someone that's well qualified, their background has been vetted because they have been the source of speculation about a potential nomination. So I think all this is actually quite helpful. Obviously, it's uncomfortable for a potential nominee, but this is the big leagues, and if you're going to serve on the Supreme Court, this is what you have to go through.
Professor Guineer, the same question to you. Back in 1993, when you were nominated by President Clinton as Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, your nomination was subjected to intense scrutiny, both political and media scrutiny. I wanted to ask what role you think the media coverage plays in this process.
Well, I frankly think that the media coverage is a distraction, and that the real question, going back to what Charles Ogletree was saying, is what are the qualities that this person is going to bring to the bench that are currently missing from the bench? And one of the things that you haven't raised in terms of putting this in context is that Republicans lost the last election, and yet a Republican president has nominated 7 of the 9 justices who currently serve on the court, including Justice Souter. And so the real question is, what does President Obama need to do in terms of bringing some context and legitimacy to the court so that it is functioning in a way that is responsive to where the country is right now? That's number one. Number two, I think that the most important thing that a justice appointed by President Obama will do is to be a passionate dissenter, because frankly, there are 5 reliable conservative votes on the court, and it's unlikely that whomever President Obama appoints is going to be writing a lot of very liberal majority opinions. But they can speak to a constituency of accountability to give people a sense that there is hope, there are alternative ways of mobilizing to change the rulings of this conservative majority. So I think we are focusing on the wrong issues in terms of just the ethnicity or the race or the gender of the candidate, although obviously those are important. I think they have to be seen in context. Will this person speak in a voice that the people can understand and that's going to give them a sense that the court is actually speaking democratically about encouraging them to act democratically about the issues that most matter?
And when you say context and legitimacy, what do you mean? Are you suggesting because the majority of the justices were named by Republican presidents that they're not seen as legitimate by the country? Or
no, I'm
what do you mean?
That because a majority of the justices were named by Republican presidents, you have a very conservative majority on the court without regard to whom President Obama picks to take the Souter seat, number one. Number two, the 2 of the people that are considered part of the so-called liberal minority were appointed by Republicans, and they are, frankly, moderate Republicans. These are not passionate liberals. So when we're thinking about the composition of the court, we really have to think about how the court reflects the composition of the country and not just the particular qualities of an individual justice in terms of his or her race or ethnicity.
I wanted to again cite the president's words when he said, "I view the quality of empathy, of understanding and identifying with people's hopes and struggles as an essential quality for arriving at just decisions and outcomes." I wanted to ask you, Attorney General Gonzalez, do you agree with that? Do you think that's appropriate?
Well, I think everyone wants to think that their government officials are kind, compassionate people, and I think someone having that kind of image is certainly helpful in a confirmation hearing. I do worry a little bit. I worry about justices on the court making decisions based on what they think makes them feel good. I don't think it's fair to expect society to anticipate the outcome of a case based upon what makes a justice feel good. In essence, what you're saying, I think, is that I don't care what the law says. I'm going to pursue an outcome that I think is fair and just. I'm going to rewrite the law, and I think that's dangerous. And so, again, I agree that we want our justices to be compassionate, to be kind people. But I think their job as a member of the court, quite frankly, is to apply the law. And I think the notion that we worry about the outcome – you know, I serve as a justice on the Supreme Court of Texas, and sometimes I reach decisions that I didn't like the outcome, but I felt that I had a duty to my oath of office to respect the words of the statute that I was interpreting.
Professor Guinier, what do you think the president means, and do you agree with his perspective on this?
Well, I think that what President Obama means is, and here I would take some issue with what Alberto Gonzalez just said, that if there are many cases in which the law is very clear and in which the weight of precedent moves in a very certain direction. But there are also many cases which are controversial, in which the law is ambiguous, and in which the justices bring their own lived experience to the resolution of this ambiguity. And the best example I can think of is Ruth Bader Ginsburg bringing her experience as an advocate for women before she came on the court, and then in the case of Lilly Ledbetter, issuing a very powerful, very passionate oral dissent saying that the way in which her male colleagues had interpreted a provision of a congressional statute was was obviously tone deaf to the experience of women, especially women who are the first woman in an all-male workplace. So this was a pay equity case, and she was speaking on behalf of the experience of women that was not being considered, in her view, by her colleagues. And she called on Congress to change the law to make it clear what it meant. And in fact, that was the first piece of legislation that President Obama signed when he became president, the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. And I think that's what he's talking about, is somebody who understands the lived experience of ordinary Americans.
Okay. Final thought from you, Professor Ogletree.
Yes. First of all, the idea that empathy is a liberal term is crazy. What the president's talking about is someone who understands and can see from the point of view of someone different. And his model of a great justice was Earl Warren, a Republican from California, the former governor, who was responsible in some respects for the internment of 100,000 Japanese Americans during the Second World War. But he was empathetic because he, is told, drove to Virginia with his driver, thinking about the Brown decision, and came out the next morning and saw his driver in the car and said, what are you doing here? The driver said, well, sir, I can't sleep at a hotel here because I'm black. It gave Earl Warren a sense about the reality of America. It wasn't just a technical case. It was about a person who could not be treated right and fair because of his race. And I think this president, given his own background, his history, and his brilliance as a constitutional scholar, will pick the right person who will be empathetic, but in a way that understands it. It's not liberal or conservative. It's empathy, understanding the other person's point of view. And I'm very excited about what he will be doing quite soon.
Charles Ogletree is a professor at Harvard Law School. He's the founder and executive director of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice. He joined us from the university's studios. Also joining us today was fellow Harvard Law professor Lonnie Guinier. Gee, I wonder if that's a sexist term, but also at Harvard, a professor at Harvard Law School, Lonnie Guinier. She joined us by phone from California, here with me in our Washington, D.C. studios, the former Attorney General of the United States, Alberto Gonzalez. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We go now from the High Court to higher education. President Obama has unveiled his proposed education budget. It calls for increased funding for a number of programs, but overall there were cuts in funding for historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs. A two-year-old program providing $85 million to black colleges and universities was eliminated by the White House. The tribal colleges also sustained a cut. The funding was designed to be temporary, but leaders of these schools say they are going to challenge the Obama administration on this. Here to talk about what this might mean is Michael Lomax, the president and CEO of the United Negro College Fund. Welcome, sir. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What is this money used for?
Well, first of all, let's just recognize that it was about $500 million in additional aid given to minority-serving institutions 2 years ago as a part of the College Cost Reduction Act. When the Pell Grant was raised 2 years ago by the new Democratic Congress, they also, in their wisdom, decided that institutions which have a disproportionately large number of low-income and minority students needed additional support to be able to meet the needs of those students by keeping their costs down. And so $85 million was given to historically black colleges for two years. So for $170 million, $200 million for Hispanic-serving institutions, $60 million for tribal colleges. And that all added up to about $500 million. It was a two-year sunset. And at that time, Senator Obama supported this vigorously. And this enabled these institutions, which have a disproportionately large number of low-income students, students who come to them academically not as well prepared. They had the resources to better support them and to keep their costs down, and that's what these dollars are used for.
But traditionally, funding has flowed to the students, not to the institutions. This particular kind of funding mechanism is considered unusual in higher education.
That's not accurate because, you know, we've had Title IIIB, which supports institutions, historically black colleges, for decades. And this is funding which has been made available to these institutions to be used at the discretion of the president to ensure the academic and institutional integrity of the institution.
What exactly was the money used for, and what impact do you think this cut will have if it is sustained?
Well, you know, cost of higher education is great, and institutions are experiencing increases in everything from light bills to compensating faculty. And so that's what these dollars are used for. They're used to keep the cost down and to ensure high academic standards at the institutions. Pell Grants, which we have increased and which the president supported and we are very appreciative of, really that's access money for the individual student. That student can take those dollars anywhere he or she chooses to attend.
There are those who would argue that perhaps the taxpayers aren't getting their money's worth. There was an Associated Press study earlier this year that looked at the graduation rates for 83 federally designated four-year HBCUs and found that they had an average graduation rate of just 37%. And with statistics like that, there are those who would argue, is this money
really
being
well used?
Well,
the average graduation rate is about 43%. So that of the ones selected for the AP story, they were about 6 percentage points below on average.
But that's well below the overall graduation rate.
That's an overall five-year graduation rate, yes. We have institutions, historically black colleges, which have 80% graduation rates. And UNCF's position is that these institutions have been historically underfunded. They have a disproportionate percentage of low-income students who come to them academically not well prepared. And that what this administration, we hope, will do is say that these are institutions which, if invested in more significantly, can perform at a higher level. We need to invest in them, hold them accountable to increase their graduation rates, and make sure that they're helping to produce the college graduates that this country
needs. To be continued. An important discussion. Michael Lomax is the president and CEO of the United Negro College Fund. He was kind enough to join us from our studios in New York. Thank you, Mr. Lomax. Next, we will hear from the 16th president of Howard University, Sidney Ribeau. That's next on Tell Me More from NPR News.